Kate was craning her neck this way and that. "I'm glad, but it's not going to be much use. We're too high up." She studied the roofs across the courtyard for clues about the roof directly above them, then shook her head. "There's no good way to climb up either. Not even a gargoyle to lasso. Just standard old gutters. Although," she frowned, "no, never mind, that wouldn't work." "What were you about to say?" Sticky asked. "Maybe if the rest of us hear it." "No, really, it won't work." It wasn't quite like Kate to say something couldn't work, much less to refuse even to discuss it. Everyone looked at her quizzically. She might be an accomplished trickster around her enemies, but to her friends she was remarkably transparent. "What are you trying to hide, Kate?" Rennie asked. "What's going on?" Kate had walked away from the window as if to dismiss it out of hand. "Nothing. I'll tell you later. Right now we should put the bookcase back up." "She thinks she could get away," exclaimed Constance, who had been staring keenly at Kate's troubled face. Kate looked stunned, then quickly tried to recover. But try as she might, she couldn't hide her guilty expression. She could hardly have looked more shamefaced if she'd been caught stealing. "Is that right, Kate?" Sticky asked, his eyes growing round with hope. "But that's great. Why wouldn't you tell us?" Kate shook her head, fretfully knitting her brow. "I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. It's not like I can keep from having ideas, right? I didn't mean to..." Rennie was going to ask Kate what in the world she was talking about. She seemed to have misunderstood Sticky's question, when suddenly he understood. Kate believed she could get away, but not the rest of them. And she wasn't about to leave her friends behind. She was ashamed even to have thought of it. "Kate," Rennie said urgently, "listen, you have to do it. If you think you can, you have to. It's our best chance. You could figure out where we are, then find your way back to Mr. Benedict and the others. They'll know what to do to rescue us, don't you see?" Kate was bouncing on the balls of her feet, her face tense with distress. In fact, she looked like someone who desperately needed to find a bathroom. "Oh, of course I see, Rennie, but how can I possibly..." "No, I just can't do it." Sticky grabbed her arm. "Yes, you can, Kate. You can and you will. Don't worry about us. We'll be all right, but only if you go and get help." Rarely had Sticky spoken with such force, and Kate was somewhat taken aback. She stood blinking at him a moment, then gave a small, tight nod. "You're right. I know you can manage without me, of course, and..." "All right, I'll go." Her decision made, Kate was once again her usual self, and her usual self was all action. Retrieving her rope and Swiss Army knife from Rennie, she wrapped the rope around her waist, tucked her shirt in over it so that it was hidden, then opened the short blade on the knife. She had already noticed that the window was painted shut, and with precise, deft strokes, she began to work her way along the frame, cutting through the paint. As Sticky and Constance watched her work, Rennie was watching Sticky. Now that his forceful speech to Kate was finished, he seemed more anxious than ever. In fact, he was gazing mournfully at Kate, as if he would never see her again. And Rennie was struck by a sudden realization. Sticky had done his best to convince Kate to go, not because he thought she could save them, a doubtful prospect at best, but simply because he hoped she could save herself. And he said exactly the right thing, too, Rennie thought. He knew she needed to see that we'd be all right. Rennie turned away, fairly overcome by a surge of emotions, pride in his friend, concern for Kate's safety, and fear that Sticky was right, that they might not ever see Kate again. He started pacing the room, averting his eyes. Kate needed to go at once. She didn't need distractions. And so Rennie paced. And as he did, his thoughts circled around Kate's escape attempt. What if someone was watching out of one of those other windows? What if she had to break a window or pick a lock to get out of that courtyard? Could she do that quietly? And how did she mean to get down into that courtyard anyway? Rennie went over those questions again and again, until he was so distracted himself that Constance had to speak his name twice to get his attention. "Clean out your ears, Rennie," she said. "Kate's ready." Rennie turned to see the others looking at him. Kate had gotten the window open, and apparently had already said her goodbyes to Sticky and Constance. She was beaming at him, her old confident self, and despite his strange turmoil of emotion, Rennie couldn't help but smile back. He hurried over and hugged her. "Be careful," he said. Kate winked. "You know me," and with that she leaped out the window. Secret Communications. None of them was prepared for Kate's dramatic exit. They gasped in unison and jumped forward to grab her. But she was already out of reach, and bumping together at the open window, they saw what Kate had done. At the last instant, she had spun and kicked off against the window ledge, kicked off sideways so that she hurtled several feet through the air, parallel to the wall, in a trajectory that brought her to a metal drainpipe, which she had latched onto with her astonishingly strong hands. Already, she was scrambling down it toward the ground far below, as comfortable as a monkey in a tree. But once again, Rennie and Sticky couldn't help covering their eyes. They might trust Kate's agility, but they had little reason to trust the drainpipe's sturdiness. "She's down," Constance whispered, to their relief. "She's running around checking doors." Now the boys felt even more anxious, but they forced themselves to look. There she was, darting first to one door and then the next, trying each one gingerly, quietly, cautious, lest someone be standing on the other side. After several tries, one of the doors in the opposite wing opened, and Kate disappeared. They watched the vacant courtyard for a while, but Kate didn't reappear, and with a strange mixture of sadness and hope, they closed the window. The boys applied themselves to righting the tilted bookcase. It was much harder to do without Kate, even more so to do it quietly, but with a good deal of straining, they got the bookcase up again. At least now, if someone glanced into the room, it wouldn't be instantly apparent that something was amiss. Anything more than a glance, of course, would reveal that an entire person was amiss. But Kate could use as many valuable extra seconds as her friends could give her. In the tense minutes that followed, they stood perfectly still in the middle of the room, listening for sounds of an outcry or alarm. Then, just as their tentative hopes were blossoming into real optimism, they heard exactly what they had been listening for, exactly what they had wanted so badly not to hear. Distant shouts and crashes, radios squawking, and worst of all, someone laughing. They looked at one another and then away again, not wanting to believe it and too upset for words. Eventually, Constance hung her head and mumbled, "Here they come." Footsteps echoed in the hall, the door was unlocked and flung open, and Kate came sprawling into the room. She was panting and wobbly from her struggles, her hair had come loose from its ponytail, and her cheeks were bright red, but she seemed unhurt. Indeed, no sooner had she hit the floor than she was back on her feet and charging, staggering really, at McCracken, who had so unceremoniously tossed her into the room. He was ready for her, and with a careless sweep of his arms, he spun her about and sent her crashing to the floor again. This time, her friends caught hold of her and held her back. "Tisk, tisk," said McCracken. "I thought we agreed to part on peaceful terms." "I never agreed to anything of the sort," shouted Kate, still very worked up. "Hmm," said McCracken, as Mr. Curtin, scowling, rolled into the room behind him. "It certainly sounded like you agreed, but then I was holding you upside down at the time, so perhaps I misunderstood you." "You didn't waste any time, did you, Miss Weatherall?" Mr. Curtin snapped. "Any of your time, I should say. My own valuable time is a different matter. I have work to be doing. Springing from his wheelchair, he strode angrily over to the huddled children. Did I not say that any disturbances would be punished, he said, already pulling on his shiny silver gloves. Fine, Kate cried, raising her chin defiantly. Get it over with, and go back to your precious nasty work. As you wish, Mr. Curtin said, and elbowing Kate aside, he seized Rennie by the arm. Rennie felt as if he'd been struck by lightning. Everything flashed white and red and flew apart, as if the room itself had exploded, and searing pain seemed to erupt from every part of his body at once, his face, his hands, even his toes, and then he was lying on the floor. When the fiery pain subsided and his eyes regained their focus, the familiar faces of his friends swam blearily above him, and Kate was weeping. "It isn't fair," she was shouting furiously through her tears. "It wasn't Rennie who tried to escape. You never said—" "I decide what is fair and what isn't," Mr. Curtin said coolly. "You will all do well to remember that, especially you, Miss Weatherall. The next time my work is interrupted, I shall extend the punishment to everyone." He leaped into his wheelchair again and spun it about. "McCracken, have SQ come see me in my workspace. Apparently I must remind him how to lock a door." "Funny," said McCracken, his brow wrinkling. "It was locked when we came in just now." He looked at Kate askance. "Were you really so clever as to lock it behind you to throw off suspicion?" "A monkey would have thought of that, McCracken," said Mr. Curtin, irritably. "Perhaps in the future I shall hire monkeys. They certainly couldn't do a worse job. In the meantime, you will post a guard in the corridor as an added precaution." With that, Mr. Curtin shot from the room, and McCracken, wagging his finger at the children in amused disapproval, followed after him and locked the door. It took some time for Kate to calm down. She kept apologizing to Rennie, then railing against Mr. Curtin as her friends tried to shush her. Finally, when Rennie managed a weak smile and laid a finger to his lips, she got control of herself. "Right," she said, wiping away her tears. "Sorry, I'll be quiet. I've already done enough." "Not you," said Sticky through clenched teeth. "Them." "He's right," Rennie said. "It isn't your fault. We all wanted you to go, didn't we? So stop beating yourself up. Anyway, I'm already feeling better. You know it doesn't last that long." Kate remembered all too well how long it lasted. Mr. Curtin had used those gloves on her before, too. And if memory served her, Rennie probably still felt queasy and shaken, but was putting on a brave face. She nodded and said nothing more, busying herself instead with retying her ponytail. It was no help dwelling on what was already done, but she still felt terrible all the same. "What happened out there?" Constance asked her. "We're in some sort of complex," Kate muttered. "There are high walls all around it, and they put razor wire on top of the walls. Sharp spotted me before I could find a way out." Kate didn't much feel like talking, but naturally the others kept asking questions, and soon she had told them everything. She had sneaked through several corridors of the building without encountering a soul, then gone out an exterior door, and found herself in what looked to be an abandoned construction site. There were great mounds of rubble and debris everywhere, and scattered heavy equipment, all surrounded by those high walls. She'd been spotted right away, unfortunately, and was too busy running for her life to investigate properly, but it was clear the complex was in the process of being demolished or renovated, or had been, at any rate. There were no workers anywhere, and everything was as still as a graveyard. "It's like a fortress or a military base or something," Kate said. "I don't know. I was pretty focused on finding a gap in that wall. One part at the back of the complex looked ready to topple. I think there was an accident. There's a huge crane nearby. but there wasn't a single hole big enough for even a rabbit to squeeze through. And there's a gate at the front, as high as the walls and topped with the same kind of wire, and it was guarded by 10 men. But I got an idea that I could maybe smash through it with the salamander, except that I worried about that wire coming down on top of me. "Wait a minute," Rennie said. "Back up. You were driving the salamander?" "I was going to. On my first time running around, I saw it parked in a sort of big temporary shed. So I doubled back to it after I got the idea about the gate. I wasn't sure I would go through with that, but I figured I would have time to decide that after I stole the salamander, provided I could get to it. That part turned out to be easy. The 10 men weren't really running. They were just kind of closing in on me, strolling along all casual and relaxed. You know how they do. About 7 or 8 of them by the end. But they'd left open a clear path to that shed, and I made a beeline for it." Kate made a disgusted face. "I'll bet you can guess who was sitting inside it waiting for me." "A kraken?" the other said. Kate nodded. "He was kneeling down so I couldn't see him over the sides. I basically jumped into his arms. The only bright side is they didn't think to search me again. I still have my rope and knife." "There's more bright side to it than that," Rennie said. "At least now we can figure out where we are."
"We can?"
"Well, Sticky probably can, right?" Rennie said.
"Sure, we can at least narrow it down," Sticky said, though he seemed uncertain why it should matter.
"Only a few places in the Stonetown area fit Kate's description. Complexes of one kind or another that were being renovated when the funding ran out. It's a big deal when work gets suspended on projects like that. It's always in the papers."
"Of course," Kate said, her aspect brightening considerably.
"And from the sound of it," Sticky continued, "I'd say we're in a prison. Did you happen to see any guard towers?"
"Yes. Sharp was up in one when he spotted me and called out to the others."
"Oh, how is it I didn't realize it was a prison, an actual prison?"
Kate rolled her eyes and snorted good-naturedly. Now that they were figuring something out, her miserable, guilty feeling was rapidly draining away. Some people might have felt guilty for cheering up so quickly, but as it was in Kate's nature to be cheerful and to look excitedly forward instead of glumly backward, the thought didn't even occur to her.
"My guess is you were distracted by the 10 men trying to capture you," Rennie said with a smile. "Anyway, there can't be many abandoned prisons within an hour's drive of Stonetown, right? Sticky, is it Solip's prison? I'm sure I remember reading about that one."
Sticky shook his head.
"I wish it were that easy. Solip's prison and Third Island prison were both slated for major renovation. The prisoners were temporarily transferred elsewhere, at least it was supposed to be temporary, while the work was being done. The cell blocks and outbuildings were all to be demolished and rebuilt."
"So quit beating around the bush," Constance said. "Which one are we in? Haven't you seen pictures of them somewhere? Surely both of them didn't have a weird square building like this, with 4 sides going around a pathetic little courtyard."
"Actually, that's exactly the problem," Sticky said. "Both prisons were built according to the same plan, and they were being renovated according to the same new plan. The administration buildings were to be left intact, while everything else was torn down and rebuilt. I think it's safe to say we're in the administration building of one of those prisons, but I have no idea which one."
"Good grief," Kate said, "and we were so close."
"We aren't finished yet," said Rennie. "Solip's prison is due north of Stonetown, isn't it, Sticky? And Third Island is due west?"
"That's right," Sticky said.
"Then I know where we are," Rennie said. "And what's more, I have a plan."
Constance had her doubts about Rennie's plan, but then Constance had doubts about everything. Everyone else was optimistic. Hadn't Constance shown that she could transmit thoughts when she was sufficiently motivated? And when could she possibly be more motivated than now, when she was trapped in a prison and just waiting for Mr. Curtin to do his worst?
Yes, but it's an awful lot of information to communicate, she said in a low, worried tone, and I've had hardly any practice.
Come on, Constance, Kate said, grinning. It's going to be great. Just like Rennie said, it'll be perfect. We can let Mr. Benedict know where we are, but Mr. Curtin will have no clue that we did. Mr. Benedict will have the advantage again. He'll have the element of surprise.
Rennie chose not to point out that, with the four of them being held hostage, Mr. Benedict would still have a very tricky situation to deal with. The best thing now was to boost Constance's confidence. In fact, that was why he had called for an official meeting of the society. Outwardly, it might seem that sitting in a circle on the floor was hardly different from what they had been doing before, but Rennie hoped it would remind Constance of the success they'd had in the past, and that the familiar arrangement and tone would have a calming effect on her.
"Well, okay, but I can't really picture it," Constance said, doubtfully. "When I was in the library, I just stared at the call number on the spine of that book. Mr. Benedict said images probably get through more easily, so that's what I tried. But there's not much to look at here."
"We'll help you decide what to think," Rennie said, and the others agreed. And so the society began to brainstorm about the best way for Constance to communicate their situation to Mr. Benedict. It wouldn't do for him to plan a rescue attempt at the wrong prison, after all. He needed to know that they were being held in Third Island Prison, something they wouldn't have known themselves had Rennie not remembered the too bright morning sun glaring through the van's rear windows. The sun, of course, rose in the east, therefore they had been heading west. They were in Third Island, no doubt about it, and between Sticky and Kate, they had a fairly good idea about the place. For Constance's benefit, Kate laid out in greater detail what she had seen outside, and Sticky explained that the prison was situated on an island, the third one upstream from the bay, hence its name, along the widest stretch of Stonetown River.
"What is it with this guy and islands?" said Constance, rolling her eyes.
"It makes good strategic sense," Rennie said. "The prison's a defensible position, and if things go awry, he can shut down the power again and use the salamander to escape on the river."
"Do you really think he could shut it down again?" Kate said.
"I don't see why not. He still has his spies in place, and soon he'll have the Whisperer up and running again. I assume that's what he's working so busily on."
"I'm sure it is," Sticky said. "He'd want to run through all the computer programs first to see the things Mr. Benedict changed and make sure..."
"Stop, stop," Constance growled. "You're cluttering my head up. I just need to concentrate on where we are and what we know for sure, right?"
"Yes," Rennie said. "I think it's best to keep this simple. You should try to tell him what we know, focusing on the most important details. And to be safe, you should probably conjure up as many images as you can, like a neon sign flashing the words Third Island, maybe. And maybe the three of us looking out from behind prison bars," Kate suggested.
"But that might be confusing," Sticky said. "I'm sure he knows that the prison cells here were demolished."
"Yes, but it's symbolic," Kate argued.
"I know it's symbolic," Sticky said. "My point is, for the sake of clarity, we should..."
Constance frowned and shushed them, looking at the door. "Here's SQ."
Sure enough, the lock turned, the door swung open, and SQ Pedalian entered the room with a large plastic bowl of popcorn. He closed the door behind him.
"Before you say anything, you should know that speaking to me will get you punished. Mr. Curtin made that very clear to me, very clear. And it will be my duty to report you if you do. So please don't." No funny business, either. Garrett is posted in the hallway and will come running if I call out. Eskew set the large bowl on the floor and stared at it apologetically. I'm afraid it's a bit stale and there's no butter, but Mr. Curtin says that nutrition is not our main concern at the moment. He just wants to prevent your whining about your empty stomachs. For the first time, Eskew looked up and made eye contact with the children. Just so you know, I don't hold a grudge against you for what happened back on that island. I've given it a lot of thought since then, and I realize you are just scared. If I were you, I might have tricked myself, too. Not that I could trick myself, of course. I mean, not without... Well, never mind. All I mean to say is, I have no hard feelings, okay? Don't answer that. From Eskew's anxious expression, they could all tell that he'd meant what he said, that he would report them if they said even one word to him. Still, he seemed reluctant to leave and lingered there by the popcorn bowl, nudging it with his tattered boot as if to encourage them to eat. Finally, with a heavy sigh, he turned to go out. "Kate," Rennie said quickly, "I hope Eskew realizes that we don't have any hard feelings toward him, either. I mean, I hope he knows that we understand he's just trying to do what's right." "Surely he does, Rennie," said Kate instantly, catching on. "We've always gotten along with him, haven't we?" And Sticky and Constance, in rather awkward, self-conscious voices, hastened to agree. Eskew, listening intently, turned back to them with a grateful smile. "Thanks," he said. "That's pretty clever of you, incidentally." "Sticky," Rennie said, though he was looking imploringly at Eskew, "I wonder if Eskew would be willing to tell us what's going on. I'll bet he can imagine how frustrating it is to be held captive and not even know why. Like he said himself, we're just scared." Eskew looked troubled. I don't know. I mean, my orders don't specifically state..." "You're right, Rennie," Sticky said. "It would be very kind of him." Eskew pressed a knuckle against his lips and glanced at the door. "I suppose it wouldn't hurt just to... Well, it's all very simple, really. As you know, if you hadn't been deceived by a malicious false report, Mr. Curtin only wants to stabilize the country. He wants to protect it. But there are powerful people in the government who don't listen to reason. They only want to hold on to their power, no matter how bad it is for everyone else." "You think Mr. Curtin is just trying to help?" Constance said incredulously. Then, seeing her friend's horrified looks, she quickly added, "I'm asking Rennie." And somewhat desperately, she went on, "Well, Rennie, is that what you think? Rennie, is it Rennie?" "I don't know, Constance," said Rennie. "Maybe he is." Plainly relieved, Eskew said, "I assure you he is. And he has several friends in government who understand this. That's why they've arranged to bring the very best government advisers to have a secret meeting with Mr. Curtin later this afternoon. Together, they're going to work out a way to ensure all the major cities have a safe and steady power supply. Thanks to Mr. Curtin's expertise, new tidal turbines can be built, power grids updated and vastly improved, new systems put in place. Trust me, it's all going to be much, much better for everyone. And once the higher-ups see what Mr. Curtin really means to do, what he's been trying to do all along, well, they'll change their minds and support him. He'll no longer be considered a criminal." Eskew paused, then added with feeling, "And neither will I." The children looked gravely at one another. They had no doubt that these friends Eskew spoke of were actually spies, and that this very afternoon Mr. Curtin would be using his whisperer to extract valuable secrets from the advisers that his spies were bringing to him. And afterward, he could simply sweep away their memories of that unpleasant experience, and no one would be the wiser. "Rennie," said Kate, "I still don't understand why Mr. Curtin needs us." "Oh, that part is more complicated," Eskew said. "Even I have trouble understanding it,
But it comes down to other people, foolish, wicked people, trying to ruin Mr. Curtin's chances. He's been forced to use some unusual methods to clear up the situation. He only has one weakness, really. And Mr. Benedict has information that would help him get rid of it. But Mr. Benedict has been corrupted and is unwilling to help. So Mr. Curtin has had to involve you. I'm not sure why, but the important thing is that it will all work out fine if you just do as he says.
Constance, said Rennie, I wonder if Eskew really truly believes that.
Eskew's face clouded at this. For a moment he stood frozen, his eyes darting quickly this way and that, as if seeking answers or comfort in the corners of the room. I have to go, he said abruptly, and hurried to the door. Garrett will wonder what's taking me so long.
Rennie, forgetting himself, almost called out after him. And then Eskew was out the door, and they all heard the turning of the lock. Time was growing short. By this afternoon, Mr. Curtin might be too powerful for anyone to have any chance of stopping him. Everything now seemed to depend on Constance's ability to send her thoughts clearly and accurately across an unknown number of miles into the mind of Mr. Benedict. It was no surprise that she was feeling the pressure. She had once thwarted the Whisperer itself, but that fight had called for a straightforward, stubborn resistance. Her courage and obstinance had saved the day. This time was different, the task far more complex. Never had Constance worked so hard or for so long. Minutes passed, and then an hour, and still she worked. And all it seemed she was doing was lying on the floor with her eyes squeezed tightly closed. In reality, her friends knew she was sending out her thoughts again and again, then listening carefully for any kind of response. Rennie, Kate, and Sticky maintained perfect silence, breathing as softly as they could, and trying hard, in Sticky's case extremely hard, not even to scratch their itches or stretch their legs. They knew that Constance's ability to concentrate was of the utmost importance, that their fate, and indeed the fate of everyone they held dear, depended on Constance's success. Thus it was not a little disconcerting when Constance began to snore. "Constance!" they cried, alarmed. "Constance, wake up!" Constance sat up with a start, then scowled and rubbed her eyes. "What? What is it? What's wrong?" Lowering her fists, she noticed their stricken looks and said, "Oh, I guess I fell asleep."
"Constance, how could you?" said Kate, shaking her head.
"I don't know. I didn't realize I did. I'd sent out the message for about the 100th time, and each time I thought maybe I could hear Mr. Benedict saying something to me. But it was muddled and quiet. I couldn't make out a word of it. And as far as I know, it was my own imagination doing it, right? I mean, if what you want more than anything is to hear someone's voice in your head—" She yawned and stretched. "I can't believe I fell asleep, though. I was a nervous wreck until—" "Oh!"
"Oh, what?" Rennie said.
"I remember what happened," Constance said, closing her eyes and putting her fingertips to her temples. "I got this picture in my head, and it was so comforting it made me relax." She opened her eyes. "I think I was so exhausted that relaxing for even a second just put me right out."
"The same thing happened to me in the van," Rennie said.
"What was the picture?"
"It was Mr. Benedict and everybody. They all looked funny, dressed up in silly costumes, and all of them grinning at me."
Constance smiled. "Better yet, they were all holding pies, mucho brazos pies. I could practically smell them."
"Sounds to me like you were already dreaming," Sticky said.
Constance considered this.
"Maybe so. It was an awfully silly image to have pop into my head."
Rennie, however, was growing excited. "Constance," he said urgently, "don't you think it might have been a message from Mr. Benedict?"
"Oh, I don't know. I suppose it might have been.
She pursed her lips, thinking. If so, I can't imagine what he meant by it. Maybe he just wanted to make me laugh and feel better. Maybe it was his way of telling me everything will be all right. That was the feeling it gave me, anyway. Unconvinced, Rennie pressed for details. Who had Constance meant by everybody? What were the silly costumes? And how did she know they were Mucho Brazos pies? Constance replied matter-of-factly that everybody meant Milligan, Rhonda, and Number Two, that the costumes were just silly disguises, big fake mustaches, trench coats, and hats, and that, of course, the pies had been made by Mucho, because who else would have made them? It's true, they were shaped oddly, though, said Constance upon reflection. They were baked in the shape of S's. Like the letter S, Dickie said? What for? How on earth would I know? Maybe it stands for something. Safety or security, maybe. Like I said, the picture made me feel better. Maybe it was supposed to give me a feeling of being safe at home. Assuming it wasn't just a dream after all, said Kate, looking at Rennie to see what he made of it. Rennie was rubbing his chin. Are you sure that was the only image you saw, Constance, and there weren't any words to go along with it? Oh, sure, there were lots of words, but I couldn't possibly tell you if they came from Mr. Benedict or from me. They were all in a jumble, and anyway, they were all words I'd been thinking myself. All that stuff about Mr. Curtin's plan and the prison and the spies bringing those advisors here. Basically everything I'd been trying to send to Mr. Benedict, only it was in fragments and snippets. Sometimes it seemed like they were in my own voice, and sometimes in Mr. Benedict's. I don't know. If he was trying to tell me something, he wasn't doing a very good job of it. Constance found herself suddenly famished, and as Rennie and the others discussed what the image might mean, she made short work of the stale popcorn, cramming it into her mouth by the handful. The more they talked, the less certain Sticky and Kate were that the image actually came from Mr. Benedict. Rennie, on the other hand, strongly suspected that it did. He felt the image seemed meaningful somehow, but for the life of him he couldn't say why, and even if it did come from Mr. Benedict, whether he had sent it on purpose or Constance's probing mind had cobbled it together out of his thoughts, seemed impossible to gauge. Furthermore, if he had sent it on purpose, it may well have lost some of its supporting detail in the transmission. So the image, tantalizing though it was, seemed unlikely to do them any good. "Maybe we should take a little break," Constance said, when they had exhausted themselves talking about it, and she had stuffed herself with popcorn. Her eyelids had begun to droop. "Just a tiny, short one to sort of," she yawned, "sort of rest a minute while we think about this some more. I can tell you're all tired." And without further ado, she curled up on her side and fell asleep with her mouth open. Sticky looked at her enviously. "I wish I could do that." Rennie shook his head. "I think the strain took a lot out of her. She isn't used to working very hard, you know." "That would be an understatement," said Kate, checking the popcorn bowl. It was empty, of course. Stated Reasons and Sudden Insights. As Constance slept, Sticky and Kate began discussing other ways to get out of their predicament, for neither of them had any confidence that Mr. Benedict had received Constance's message. Rennie still felt otherwise, however, and he continued to ponder what the strange image in her head could possibly have meant. He kept thinking he could make sense of it if he tried hard enough, or thought about it in the right way, but it was no easy matter to find significance in silly disguises and S-shaped pies. For a long time, he paced along the far side of the room, tuning out the whispers of Sticky and Kate, who knew to leave him alone at times like these. Finally, though, taking a break to clear his thoughts before trying again, he realized they were arguing. "You have to do it," Sticky said. "No way," Kate said emphatically. "Just drop it, okay?" "What are you talking about?" Rennie asked, coming over to them. Sticky looked up at him beseechingly. "You realize she could try again, don't you? Mr. Curtin thinks SQ left the door unlocked. No one realizes she got out through the window." "That's true," said Rennie, surprised. "Why didn't I think of that?" "But I'm not going to do it, and that's that," Kate said. "But you know more this time," Sticky insisted. "You could have a plan, and we could make a distraction or something." "For what?" said Kate, waving him off. "A chance to save my own skin and leave the rest of you to be punished? Maybe even brain swept? And then live the rest of my life knowing I escaped when you couldn't? Forget it!" Rennie quickly took Sticky's side in the argument, pointing out that she could try to contact Mr. Benedict and tell him where they were. But it did no good. Kate was adamant. "We know now that we're a long way from anywhere, right? So it's a long shot at best. I might manage it in time, but then again I might not. Look," Kate said, her expression softening, "don't think I'm not aware of what you're suggesting. You're both willing to risk some awful punishment just so I can get away, but I'm not willing to risk it, especially since our chances are better if we stick together." "But you don't know that," Rennie protested. "I keep messing up, I forget things, I don't think clearly." He cut himself off, biting his lip in frustration. Kate clucked her tongue. "That's another thing, Rennie. You are being too hard on yourself. You can't think of everything all the time. No one can. I can't do any of this alone. Neither can Sticky, and neither can you. You know that. Maybe you just forget it because you feel responsible. But you aren't responsible for all of us, you know. I mean, we're all responsible, right?" Rennie looked away, feeling strangely embarrassed. "I know that. Of course I know that. It isn't like I think I have to solve every problem." But even as he said it, he realized that he did. "Anyway," he went on quickly, "the point is you can't count on me to figure a way out of this. You should make a break for it while you can." "I didn't say I count on you to figure a way out," Kate said. Then she frowned. "I guess it's true. I usually do expect you to, which is my own way of being too hard on you, isn't it? Sorry for that. But I'm not counting on you this time, I promise. I'm counting on us. Just because we don't have an answer right now doesn't mean we won't have one soon. So you can quit trying to get me to go, both of you. I'm through talking about it. Got it?" Rennie and Sticky had no good answer for this. At any rate, they both felt encouraged by Kate's speech, for wasn't she right? Didn't they always manage together? "Got it," said Sticky. "Got it," said Rennie. "Good," said Kate, and all of them smiled. Rennie's mind had wandered from the problem of the image Constance had seen to the very real prospect of being brainswept by the Whisperer, something he had been trying hard not to think about, and he had just arrived at the despairing thought that soon he might not recognize the faces of his friends, that these trying moments might well be the last ones the society ever spent together. It was hard to imagine, and even harder to bear, so it was almost a relief when Constance's eyes sprang open and she sat up. Almost, but not quite. "Crawlings is here," Constance said. Rennie shivered, unnerved by the feeling that some ghostly ten-man was among them without their knowing it. Kate and Sticky, feeling much the same, stopped whispering and looked toward the door. For a long minute, no one spoke or moved. There were no footsteps, no noises in the hall. Even Constance began to suspect she'd been wrong. But then the lock turned, the door inched open, and like a turtle easing out of its shell, Crawling's pale, bald head slowly poked in through the door. He wriggled his eyebrow and leered at the children. "Oh, come now, kittens, don't stop whispering on my behalf."
"But that would be rude," Kate replied. "We were whispering about you, after all, and I'm afraid we weren't saying very nice things."
"Crawlings doesn't care about rudeness," Constance said. "Or doesn't he know that it's rude to listen in on people?"
Crawlings snickered.
"Oh, yes," he said, sauntering on into the room. "That would be very rude indeed. But I don't quite count children as people, you see. It's true they rather resemble people, but then so do puppets."
His brow wrinkled, and he began fiddling with the clasp on his briefcase, as if considering whether to open it.
"Now, what did I come in here to do? I'm trying to remember."
"Let us go," Sticky ventured, weakly, his eyes fixed on the briefcase.
Crawlings pretended to consider this.
"No, no, I don't believe it was that," he said. He tapped his chin with his long, spidery fingers. "Something to do with my briefcase, maybe."
The children watched him in silence. Crawlings was clearly toying with them, but still their nerves stood on end as they waited. He went so far as opening his briefcase and peeking at them to observe their response. They only stared blankly at him, however, and looking faintly disappointed that they hadn't whimpered or begged for mercy, he closed it again and snapped his fingers.
"I have it. I'm to bring you to Mr. Curtin's workspace for a quick word. Emphasis on quick. He's very busy. So chop, chop, little puppets. Let's hurry along." And like a loving father, Crawlings grabbed Kate by the hand and swung it playfully back and forth between them. "I believe I'll keep you close, my dear. The rest of you may walk in front of us." They had hardly taken two steps before Crawlings stopped, released Kate's hand, and flexed his fingers with a troubled expression.
"I'm impressed with your grip, Kadigans, but you had better stop squeezing so hard, or mean old Crawlings may have to squeeze back."
Kate looked up at him innocently.
"But I wasn't squeezing hard," she said, batting her eyelashes.
Crawlings narrowed his eyes and took her hand again, telling the others which direction to go. They proceeded down a long corridor and into an elevator.
"Mr. Curtin put you as far away from him as possible," Crawlings explained as the elevator descended. "He has so much work to do, and children can be so noisy, you know. Though I suppose you don't notice this yourselves."
"We're more bothered by smells," Constance said, holding her nose. For in the close confines of the elevator, Crawlings' cologne was almost overpowering. Crawlings grunted and muttered something about inferior sensibilities. When the elevator door slid open, he leaned out and whispered to someone in the corridor, "Is he ready for them?"
"He was," came the whispered reply. "But you were late, so now he's speaking to McCracken."
Rennie perked up his ears at this. Sure enough, he could just make out Mr. Curtin's voice in the background. "You're to go in the instant they're finished talking."
"Am I really late?" Crawlings asked, checking one of his watches.
He frowned and checked the other one, looking concerned. Perhaps now he regretted the time he'd wasted intimidating the children.
"Did you at least fetch his juice from the basement?" whispered the other 10 men. "He called for it again."
Crawling's eyebrow rose in dismay.
"We'll go right now and bring them back."
His eyes shot over to Rennie, who had abruptly begun pressing the elevator buttons for all the higher floors, including one for the roof. With an angry cry, he slapped Rennie's hand away from the panel.
"You little fool, what are you doing?"
Rubbing his stinging hand, Rennie stepped away and averted his eyes.
Crawlings gritted his teeth.
"We'll settle this later," he hissed. "Get out, all of you." As the children filed out, he whispered down the corridor to the other 10 men.
"I'm taking the stairs. Keep an eye on the urchins, will you? Send them in if he finishes with McCracken."
"Crawlings, old sport, you know it isn't my job to—"
But Crawlings was already scuttling off and pretended not to hear.
The other 10 men sighed and regarded the children from his post outside an open doorway.
He was unfamiliar to them, a slight, swarthy man in a dapper seersucker suit, with a bandage on his forehead that Kate suspected was the result of the flashlight she had thrown outside Mr. Benedict's house. In the darkness, she hadn't gotten a good look at the man she'd hit. If they hadn't known he was a Tin Man, they might have thought he was kind, so gentle was his expression, and so friendly the smile he leveled at them. He was holding a newspaper, working the crossword puzzle, with an expensive-looking gold pen. Laying the pen to his lips, he indicated that they should wait quietly where they were. They nodded and stood perfectly still, all the better to listen. For this was exactly why Rennie had pressed those buttons, and the others knew it. From here they could hear Mr. Curtin and McCracken. If they had accompanied Crawlings to the basement, they would have missed their chance to eavesdrop. Mr. Curtin's voice emanated from a doorway just beyond the one the Tin Man appeared to be guarding. But even from this distance, his tone of satisfaction was unmistakable. "Here within the hour. Can you imagine that, McCracken? Has it ever occurred to you to fulfill my orders exactly on time? Oh, how rare! I'm very pleased. I cherish expedience, you know." "As do I," said McCracken. "And in this case, it is a benefit, no doubt, of your associates not having to engage with government agents. Such challenging tasks as that you leave to my men and me." Mr. Curtin screeched, or rather laughed, and said, "Try not to be defensive, McCracken. Or are you simply angling for greater compensation? I believe I pay you handsomely enough. Now, here is what I expect. You will post all of your men in the two foremost guard towers. From there, they shall be in perfect position to rain down destruction should anything not go as expected. Do you agree?"
"Certainly. You expect treachery, then?"
"Of course not. I said, should anything not go as expected, didn't I? I am careful, McCracken. You should know that by now."
"Indeed I do," said McCracken. "So careful, in fact, that you've never revealed to me the identities of these friends you're expecting. Don't mistake my meaning. I admire your caution. But do tell me how I'm to know whether to admit them. I assume there is a password?"
"I was getting to that, McCracken," Mr. Curtin said irritably. "Yes, there will be a password, but you'll see that I am cautious even with that. When the van arrives, you must radio me from the gate and describe the driver. I shall then give you a question to ask, and you must relay the response you're given. If it is correct, you'll open the gate. If not..."
"If not, we'll set about earning our pay," said McCracken. "Now, may I make one suggestion? I have more than enough men to handle any complications at the gate. Allow me to leave one in the building with you, just as an added precaution."
There was a pause. "I sense there is something more to your suggestion than you're letting on, McCracken. Tell me what it is."
"To be frank, sir, I do not entirely trust your assistant. I know he is loyal to you, and you must think so yourself, having kept him for so long. But he seems to have a soft spot for our young prisoners, and I worry he may try to help them somehow."
"I see," Mr. Curtin said in an icy tone. "You disapprove of my choice in assistance. Very well, McCracken. I shall deploy SQ to the gate with you and your men. And you may leave behind whomever you wish, your own choice in associates being so impeccable." When McCracken shrewdly chose not to reply to this, Mr. Curtin snapped, "Take Crawlings, for instance. Give him two simple tasks, and he accomplishes neither on time." And raising his voice, he called out, "I don't suppose Crawlings is here yet. Is he, Hertz?"
"He's gone for the juice," answered the Tin Man in the corridor, with a wink at the children.
"But the cherubs are here when you're ready for them."
"I am beyond ready. Send them in."
Hertz lifted his newspaper and waved the children down the corridor. As they passed the room he was guarding, they caught a glimpse of the Whisperer. in the corner, surrounded by various tools and parts. On a shelf above it sat a familiar red bucket. Kate hesitated only a moment to gaze at it, but in that moment Hertz took his pen and flicked her on the head so cruelly that her ears rang. She moved on, glowering at him over her shoulder. She could feel a knot rising, but refused to put her hand to it. Hertz smiled cheerfully at her, tapping the gold pin against his bright white teeth. "You okay?" Sticky whispered. "It sounded like he hit you with a lead pipe." "Felt like it, too," Kate whispered back, and though her head was throbbing, she added, "I'm fine. A little pain never hurt anybody, did it?" Sticky looked at her askance. "Actually," he began, but Kate quieted him with a wink. They found Mr. Curtin in a large, oval-shaped room, sitting in his wheelchair with his back to them. The walls of the room were lined with computers, and on four separate monitors, arrayed against the far wall, dense blocks of complex computer code streamed endlessly past. "Keep an eye on our guest, McCracken," said Mr. Curtin, whose own eyes were fixed intently on the screens. "Bludgeon anyone who touches anything but the floor." McCracken, standing off to the side, chuckled, "Happy to oblige." "I'm making final preparations, children," Mr. Curtin said, still watching the monitors, "making certain that all is in order. This includes you. Later today, you will be allowed to speak with your beloved Mr. Benedict by radio. He will no doubt ask you questions, and you are to be prompt and truthful in your replies. If you do this, you shall see him shortly thereafter. If not, you will be punished severely. I tell you this now so that you may prepare yourselves. I will not allow any childish nervousness or desperation to create wrinkles in an otherwise smooth operation. I would dislike it extremely, for instance, if in a panic you lied to Benedict or attempted to tell him something that might disrupt my plans. I assure you, such action would be fruitless, and it would be a shame, would it not, to suffer the painful consequences of disobedience for no reason." He paused. "You may answer." "For all we know," Rennie said, "obedience will bring painful consequences, too. What assurances can you give us that it won't?" Mr. Curtin cackled. "None. You shall have to take my word for it. But what else do you have? Tell me that." He cackled again, his shoulders shaking. He was evidently in a wonderful mood. "I do give you my word, however, if you do as I say, you will soon be reunited with your dear Benedict. I am telling the truth, am I not, Miss Contraire? I recall you have a gift for divining such things." It wasn't lost on Rennie that Mr. Curtin had made no mention of actually letting them go free, and Constance, at any rate, refused to follow Mr. Curtin's lead. "I'm even better at divining dumbness," she retorted. "You really think Mr. Benedict will give you what you want?" At this, Mr. Curtin's shoulders stiffened. But after a short pause, they relaxed again, and he said evenly, "For you and your friends, Miss Contraire, I believe he'll do whatever is necessary. He clearly prizes his little club of admirers above all else. Without you, no doubt, he feels he is nothing, for that is the sort of weak person he is. Let me ask you, then, how could I possibly care about such a person if everything else, is in my control? Benedict and his followers are mosquito bites, scarcely worth the scratching. When I have what I desire, I shall gladly be rid of you. You may go off and do whatever silly little things you wish. It will be of no consequence to me." "Because you think you'll be ruling the world?" Kate asked contemptuously, "just like last time?" Mr. Curtin's wheelchair bucked and spun about, and he glared at her with such fury that even Kate could not help but shrink away. Then his eyes closed, and his chin dropped to his chest. "Don't move," ordered McCracken in a wary tone, as if they had blundered into a den of hibernating grizzlies. For that matter, don't speak. And if you value your little legs, don't smile or smirk or any such thing.